and there were shanties on the outskirts that seemed to grow every day with new arrivals who brought stories of flood, pestilence, and war. Our city felt like the hub of a world in chaos, instead of somewhere obscure and insignificant, way out on the spinning rim of a calamity we had no power to control. Only the desperate traveled in summertime. It meant they'd given up all hope of a harvest, and were traveling in the heat and dust, trying to scavenge food as they went. Some of them were settler families who had been flooded out of homesteads to the south, but most were from much further away. Russians, Uyghurs, Chinese, Uzbeks, all rail thin, with ancient, withered faces, even their little ones. Some were too sick to be helped. The things these people were fleeing made the world my parents had left seem like paradise. In those early days, my father and the largest number of the settlers saw these people's coming as a test of their doctrine. They welcomed the incomers like lost kin. I remember one exhausted Uzbek family who were billeted at our house when I was 9 or 10. The parents scolded their children for snatching at the food as it was set down on the table. The mother picked at her meal in a restrained, delicate way, as though she was too proud to admit to her hunger. She could speak English, and she translated for the others as my mother made small talk about the life she had left. It was things I had heard 1,000 times and never paid any heed to, about the rich hiding behind a wall of money, and street lamps blocking out the starlight, and strawberries in the cooler in February, and noise and dirt and incivility. And I'll never forget the look on that man's face as he listened. There was reproach, and incredulity, and a yearning like you might see in the face of a stray animal when he catches the smell of barbecue at dusk. They must have thought we were mad. The people who came at first were not of a bad kind at all. They were placid with hunger and eager to work. What was strange was how resentment got stoked up by our charity. With nothing at all, the first incomers threw themselves on our mercy. When the edge was off their hunger, they looked around and wondered about our spare rooms, and the food that was being kept by for trading and planting, and it rankled with them. The more dangerous ones began to show up later. They were fewer in number and traveled in wintertime. That was only common sense. The winter roads made for better going, and you had summer and fall to provision yourself for the trip. They arrived in better shape. One or two had cars, most had guns. That was common sense too, but it didn't make them any more welcome. They tended to squat the outskirts of the city. At night you could see their cooking fires. Many of them were deserters. They were young, and even the best were changeable and still smarting from the indignities of the battlefield. So there we were, settlers who had forsworn the old world, only to have it fetch up on our doorstep. Us on the one side and the desperate and dangerous on the other. It was like two different species colliding. The world that had a choice, and the world that had none. The strains between us were ratcheting up in secret. And even those who noticed it didn't like to admit to it. The trouble lit slow, like one of those lazy damp leaf fires in autumn. The summer I was 14, some Russian boys were squatting a barn that belonged to a settler family called the Tumulties. Mr. Tumulty had said 2 of them could stay, but 10 came, and they ended up in dispute over it. One night in August, the barn went up in flames, and 8 of the boys were killed. They'd been drinking and cooking shashlik among the hay bales, but a rumor went round the fire had been set on purpose. The dead boy's angry friends went round to Tumulty's farm and broke his windows. When he came outside to speak with them, they roughed him up. He had a weak heart and died on the spot. The boys lit out, but the ill will stayed around the place. Settlers complained they felt unsafe. Incomers were spat at, and some shopkeepers refused to take the little tickets that were doled out to the poorest of them to buy food. Families that had been friends for years fell out over the way the incomers were getting treated. People dropped away from church or set up rival meetings. it became clear that our city was tearing itself in two. My father, as a leading man in the city, was looked to as someone who ought to give guidance. He called a gathering of the heads of families in the meeting house, the same one where I later found the fingers. So many came that the meeting had to be held outside. It was a rowdy gathering. Tumulty's son and widow were there. Mrs. Tumulty made a passionate speech naming the murderers and asking for justice. There were plenty that sided with her. But there was another faction, too, who felt the call for punishment and revenge would alter the spirit of our settlement utterly. At that time we had no police, no courts, no judges, no penal code. There had been deaths before now, but no crimes of violence. This was our Cain and Abel. Many were waiting for my father to speak. He took his time, rising slowly to his feet to speak against revenge. Pa was steeped in the Bible, and he wanted us to be moved only by love and compassion. He pointed to the feeding of the multitudes as a sign for how we should behave. Tumulty's widow shouted from her place in the crowd that we didn't have 6 magic loaves that could feed 5,000. Dad tried to handle her gently, but he pointed out to her that the loaves weren't magic. The miracle was human nature, behaving in the spirit of goodwill that multiplied in the act. In simple words, he said, when each of the 5,000 saw the fish and bread coming out, they reached into their robes and pulled out the food they'd been keeping for themselves. Fear breeds fear, Pa said. We have to offer our guests selfless support and expect nothing in return. We have enough food. The land around us is empty and big enough to absorb all that have come and more. We have to be soft enough to yield to what's inevitable, but strong enough to hold tight to our doctrine. Tumulty's widow and son took his words very badly. It seemed my father was blaming the dead man for being ungenerous. They're not people like us, said Tumulty's son Eric. Give them an inch and they take a yard. They're laughing up their sleeves at us and think we're fools for parting with what we've sweated for. They'll pay us back all right. You'll each get what my father got, 6 feet of ground for every one of you. Then a man called Michael Callard spoke up. The Callards, Michael, Freya, and their twins, Eben and Liesel, were one of the settler families who had left their home further south. The Callards had arrived with almost nothing and had lived with us for a few months before Michael Callard put up a house of their own on the other side of Delamere Street. They were devout and hard-working and well-liked by the other settlers. Eben and Liesel were 18. Liesel was shy and handsome like her mother. Eben farmed with his dad. He was proud of his strong shoulders and lean brown body. Sometimes after a day of work in summer, he would wander downtown and brave the midges with his shirt off. He was a good rider, too, and once or twice we had raced ponies on the fields outside the city. A rumor found its way back to me that we were sweet on each other. But he had always struck me as ruthless and quick-tempered, and the truth is, I have never liked a man who was too much like me. Michael Callard spoke of how his farm in the south had been attacked by armed men, how they'd been rounded up at gunpoint and given an hour to leave. He said he, like the rest of us, had come here to live in a new way, free of the threat of violence, as equals. But he was damned if he thought that meant accepting the threat of being hounded out of his own home, or having his food taken, or his wife or children hurt. He called on the able-bodied of us to form and arm a militia to keep the streets safe, and eject or punish anyone who broke the codes of the town. You could see that many were moved by his words. Even those who had persuaded themselves that all forms of violence were wrong. I watched my father as Michael Callard was speaking, and I saw trouble flit across his face. I loved my father, but I was not like him. I never needed to believe the best of people. I took them as they were, two-faced, desperate, kind, perhaps all at once. But to Pa, they were all children of God. Poor, troubled sheep who only wanted love and an even break. He needed the world to back up what his religion told him about people. and when it came down to a choice between reason and faith, he let go of his reason. They held a vote that time, and my father carried the day, but that was the start of two factions in the town. The one, led by Callard, was warm for the militia and us getting armed to defend ourselves. The other, which looked upon my pa as its head, wanted us to stick to the original spirit of the settlement. Thinking of my pa just now, I see something childish in his need for things to be perfect. He was a clumsy workman and could labor for days over something that would get tossed out if he marred it. A thing would be worthless if it wasn't just so. And that childishness fed his intolerance of people. He loved ideas more than men because they were less contradictory. And Pa sometimes seemed to be able to forgive a thief or a murderer more easily than he could forgive lateness or backtalk. Murder or theft was less troubling because wholly bad. Variety and contradiction bothered him. He was like the God of the Methodists. One word could put you out of the elect forever. I think in his love for the Arctic you see the same hunger for simple truths. Sky, snow, mountain, trees. What I found in a city, when I finally saw a real one, was disquieting. Nothing matched. It was a weird assemblage of things, but there was beauty in the oddness of it, and the thought that it was all man's doing. But the doctrine my father chose, like our landscape, had a crystal order to it. Peace, self-reliance, love, submission to the will of God. The simple shape of it had a power to persuade. People were drawn to him. The force of his conviction made them trust him. It puts me in mind of a piece of block ice, with its glassy sides sherd from the saw teeth. When you melt one for water, for the longest time the block stays perfect. It just sighs and shrinks a little. But as soon as the heat finds out a bubble of air in it, it swells and bursts the whole thing into tiny pieces. That year was one in a cluster of hot summers. The city was splitting at the seams like a fat man in his wedding suit. So many incomers, Quaker people and others, pouring up out of the scorched south, fleeing the famines. There had been squabbles all through July, people filching food from gardens or squatting empty properties and refusing to go. And as it turned out, what happened to me was the tinder that set the haystack blazing. Callard and Tumulty put their militia together, with weapons they bought off the incomers themselves, in spite of the vote going against them. The settlers who opposed them, which was the majority led by my father, dogged them throughout the summer, followed their patrols shouting and ringing bells, and sat down in the streets so their horses couldn't pass. Over the coming weeks, the arguments went on, in the meeting houses, in stores, on the sidewalks, and between husbands and wives at dinner tables. Family by family, people were won over to Callard's side. In our house, I was the cuckoo who spoke up against my own father. I had a simpler notion of right than he did. I think I was relieved when Michael Callard spoke. He gave voice to feelings I had had all my life. I said if someone slapped my face, I slapped back, no matter what the Bible said. My father went thin-lipped with disapproval and ordered me up to my room. He felt the mood going against him in the town, and it was too much to have mutiny at his own table. Those weeks were the worst I ever got on with him. The pressure he was under made him angry and bitter. He raged at Callard. He still had support among the settlers, but day by day it was ebbing away from him, and it didn't take a wild leap of the imagination to foresee a day when he stood alone. He was losing authority, and he was losing the city that he had struggled to build. He warned anyone that would listen what would happen if we followed Callard, but the number who would listen grew smaller and smaller every hour. What had started out as a quarrel over interpreting our laws was turning into a straight fight for the mastery of the city. In late August, my mother and father left the city for a few days. He liked to hunt and fish and took her when he could for company. Whenever they went away together, I would sneak into their room to sleep. I loved their deep mattress and the jingling bed frame they had brought from America. Past midnight, I heard the door open and the sound of breathing. I called out Carlo's name. It was half a dozen men with pillowcases over their heads. They had holes cut out for their eyes and mouths. There was froth on their lips as they shouted names at me. I ran to the window to jump, but they dragged me off it. Two of them held me down on the bed. I wriggled a hand free and slashed at my attacker with a water glass. "Jezebel," he said. I felt something wet on my face, and I thought he had cut me, but it was lye they'd picked up from our kitchen. The mind is merciful in what it leaves you with. I don't remember much of what followed, and less still of the aftermath, but they left me alive for my parents to find, and apparently I told them Eben Callard had been the leader. I've since wondered how I knew, and even why he would have done such a thing, but the years have taught me not to wonder too much at the dark things men do. Strange how it is that men never act crueler than when they're fighting for the sake of an idea. We've been killing since Cain over who stands closer to God. It seems to me that cruelty's just in the way of things. You drive yourself mad if you take it all personal. Those who hurt you don't have the power over you they would like. That's why they do what they do. And I'm not going to give them that power now. But it was a cruel thing that they did. And when they had finished hurting me, a splinter of loneliness seemed to break off and stay inside me forever. Nowadays I don't think of it much, but I can never hear the bed frame jingling without a sense of disquiet. What happened to me killed the hope of our city, and it killed my father, too. He took a straight razor and cut his own throat in the forest. I was too badly hurt to see him buried. For 3 weeks I had to lay in bed with a wet cloth on my face to keep the skin moist and lessen the scarring. The pain was bad, but what I remember was the noise of rioting in the street outside the window. The Callards were driven out of the city, and in the upheaval many houses burned. When the bandages came off, the skin was raw and my whole face was pulled out of true, left eye drooping, mouth awry. I'm not saying I was a looker before, but I wasn't unhandsome, and I had my good days when I could feel men respond a little quicker to me. But after that, I started wearing my hair short and mannish. When the city fathers agreed to start a militia, mine was the first name on the list. Our police rode armed and had powers of arrest. We had a code that our magistrates were supposed to enforce, and cells to remand offenders. But all we had as actual punishments were orders of interdiction, which meant in practice being evicted beyond the city limits if you were found guilty of a crime. The city fathers didn't have the stomach for anything stronger. An armed police force was bad enough. At the beginning we were able to stand in the way of mayhem, but as time wore on there was just too much of it. And we were in the crazy position of a man finding mice in his larder, who picks them up by the tail, carries them outside, and then waits for them to dig their way back in. Try how we might, the disorder multiplied. Once there had been an understanding between us about how disputes should be settled. People were direct and approached each other boldly. They had staked their futures on this experiment. We didn't all like each other, but we knew each other. Now, there was a gap between us and our neighbors, and it filled with fear and resentment. No one wanted to be the last unarmed man in the city. And if you looked for justification to arm yourself, there was plenty of it. If the Callards were capable of what they'd done, then no one could be trusted. If the salt has lost its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? People said. With my father dead, there was no one to speak up for the old ways. They junked the ideals they'd come with and bought guns. The city changed out of all recognition. The chaos seemed to draw in a particular kind of vagrant. Everything was up for grabs. In peaceful times, the steady and patient thrive, but it takes a quick and ruthless type to flourish amid disorder, and we, the citizens of our own city, were co-conspirators with them. The thing is, to people brought up on a diet of the Bible and the thought of their special place in God's plan, a global disaster is something they've secretly been longing for. We'd been talking about the millennium for centuries. Now it seemed the end time had arrived. Men like to meet a crisis head-on, wallop straight into it as though it's a test of strength. Why? Surely it's better to edge round it, fade into the background with the things you need. Spring will come again next year. There's food in the woods if you're sharp enough to know where to look. The scriptures were certainly fulfilled, though, just not in the way anyone had expected. There was no second coming, no lion and lamb lying down together, no. An orderly, modern city descended into a bunch of hungry tribes fighting over a desert. So I guess you could call the Bible a prophetic book in that sense. Bill Evans had finished his work and was looking to find a way to travel back to his home in Alaska when he got killed breaking up a fight. But that was a long time after. It took a couple of years for things to descend to that. Chapter 13. They kept me in the dark in that hole above 2 weeks. It was cold enough not to stink too bad, but that was the best you could say for it. I kept myself sane by letting my mind wander. I built up a world in my head where things had gone otherwise, and I spent my time there, instead of on the dirty blankets in the darkness. I liked to think of Ping's child growing up strong. I could see her face and her straight black hair like her mother's. I took her bathing at the lake in the mountains, and though her chin trembled in the cold water, she had a strong kick like a little frog. The food improved after the first 10 days. The soup was thicker with a little meat in it, and potatoes. I figured that they were trying to build me up for my hard labor. I wondered if they would be stupid enough to let anything resembling a weapon into my hands. Bothway didn't look like a person who would underestimate somebody, but there was no harm in hoping. Finally, one morning, they opened the door, and instead of sliding in a tin plate of food, in came a man in a farrier's apron, holding a set of manacles and a length of chain. He was followed by 2 men with cudgels who held me down while the first man fastened me into the restraints. I resisted a little, but just to keep the men occupied. One called me an ugly bitch and waved his cudgel at me, but it wasn't heartfelt. He was just showing off to his friend, and though I was wriggling, what I really wanted was to get a good look at the locks on the manacles. Unluckily for me, the men knew their work. They put me into a leather belt, and the chain passed through a loop in it to join the handcuffs with another set of restraints on my ankles. When they left me alone again, I shuffled into the brightest part of my cell and pulled a clanking length of chain into the light so I could examine it better. It was of good quality steel, heavy and well made, and it looked new. For all the hardship in Horeb, it was clear that Bothwaite wasn't cutting any corners where his enemies were concerned. I wondered about that steel, its provenance. Like the wheat flour in their stale bread, it was beyond what the people in the town seemed capable of. The farrier must have shortened it by a link or two and worked the loop into the leather belt, but his handiwork seemed gross beside the fine workmanship of the steelmaker. It seemed an awful waste of metal to me, but then Bothwaite and I had different priorities. Sometimes when you've suffered a lot, it turns out to be the small thing that breaks you. That chain almost finished me. It wasn't so much the weight as the cold of it, drawing the heat out of me and clanking when I moved. I started to reminisce about the good old days. I don't mean at home, I mean before the chain, when the cell was still stinking and cold and the food bad, but at least I had the freedom to move. Gradually it felt more and more burdensome, and to stay comfortable I had to slump, hunched up in the dirt in a posture of defeat and too tired to budge. All my dreams of escape came back to mock at me now. They seemed as unreal as my dreams of Ping and her child living. I am nothing when I can't move. I refused to eat, and I'm stubborn enough to have starved myself. except that after 2 days more, one of the jailers swung the door open and told me it was time to leave. Someone threw me a ragged quilted jacket, a hat, and a pair of greasy mittens. I thought of my warm snow sheep gloves and my wolverine pants. I wondered who was wearing them now. I put on the clothes and shuffled forward into the light, blinking like a thing that lives in darkness. The main square of Horeb was smaller than I recalled, barely the size of our backyard at home. The gates were open, and the people of the town drawn up in two rows, making a corridor for me to pass through. They stood in silence, watching me shuffle past, chains clanking. I searched their faces for some clue to where I was headed, but they were all gray and stony. Finally, I caught sight of Violet among them. "She'll wish she'd been hanged after all," she announced to the crowd, and there was a murmur of agreement. Boathwaite stood on a ledge high up on the wall of the stockade. He was dressed in a black surplice, and he had his Bible tucked under his arm. Just through the gateway, I could see men on horseback waiting for me. Boathwaite never met my eye. He called on my guards to stop, and he led his people in a prayer, entrusting me into God's care and calling on him to be merciful to me. As their voices mumbled away, I took a good look around me. It was coming up to April, and you could smell the world coming back to life after winter. The floor of the stockade was melted to slush. It seemed a long way since all the hope of the spring before. They finished their prayer with a throaty Amen. "And God have mercy on you," I cried. It had been boiling up inside me throughout the prayer, and it burst out in a crazed howl. It was so loud it split the air like a rifle crack, and those nearest to me flinched. But others muttered, "How dare she?" and pushed toward me, not so much violently but with the steady menace of a herd of cows that could trample you to death. The guards dragged me on, and I staggered, falling to my knees in the mud. They heaved me up and pushed me forward through the gateway and stopped, leaving me to walk on alone. One of the men on horseback swung down from his saddle and slipped a rope through the loop on my belt. He was practiced and indifferent, as though he was wrangling livestock or shoeing horses. Then he was back in the saddle and gave his horse a whistle. I worried that I wouldn't be able to keep up, that I would fall in the slush and be dragged, but they walked on slowly. Even then, it was hard work to stay with them. They rode along the track through the woods to where it broke out onto the main road, the place I'd come upon the men logging a lifetime earlier. I was weak from bad food and being cooped up in one place, and after each set of a dozen paces, I'd think I wasn't going to be able to make another. "The flesh is weak," they say. Me? I say the flesh is strong, but the mind is weak. It's the mind that hisses at you to give up, lay in the snow. Only women know what the body is capable of, pain that feels like it will tear you in half, but doesn't. So while my muscles cried out at me, I staggered on, counting my breaths, trying to rise out of my mind. At first I tried too desperately, and my thoughts had a sense of panic about them and wouldn't settle in one place because I was snatching at anything. But then a kind of peace came over me. I lost track of my footsteps and gave myself up to the motion. The woods were silent except for the tick of melting snow, and I thought we were alone. But as we turned onto the road, we came upon a big crowd of people camped right there on the highway. They were crouched down on their haunches, trying to rest and hold their clothing clear of the slush. One or two you could see were more hopeless and lay flat out exhausted in the wet, not caring how they would feel about it later. Around them, a dozen men slouched on horseback. The captives were chained together in groups of 10. One of my guards gave a whistle, and the group nearest to me stood up. The rider hopped down and padlocked me to the last man in the group, a fellow of about 50 with a matted beard and a worn rabbit fur cap. No one spoke. The riders made the other prisoners stand and then positioned themselves along the flanks of the line and waited. Finally, someone broke off from the front and rode up and down the line, checking that everything was to his satisfaction. He barely glanced at me, but as he turned to ride up the other flank, I saw his face and recognized him as the man I had encountered on the highway outside my own city. He galloped fast to the front of the caravan, which lay almost 60 yards away from where I stood. My companion turned to me as though he wanted to say something, but with a shout, we were in motion, and we saved all our breath for walking. Part 2. Chapter 1. The place they called the base lay almost 1,000 miles west of Evangeline, close to a tributary of the Lena. We didn't reach it until past midsummer. All the time we were just banging down the road, minding our blisters. If anything, it was more desolate than the road to the east. We didn't see a soul, just bleached bones on the road and deserted settlements beyond it. They lightened our chains to keep us moving quicker and to save on food. Each link of chain cost something in flour to carry. The caravan traveled with its own food. The covered wagons carried sacks of flour, which they mixed into porridge or cooked into griddle cakes for the prisoners. Our guards broke off to hunt sometimes, and at night the smell of their meat cooking kept us awake, teasing our noses with the smell of burnt flesh. If you were quick enough at the reveille, there might be some scraps to chew on, bones or gristle, to remind you what real food tasted of. The man beside me was a Mohammedan called Shamsuddin. 5 times a day he'd crouch, wash his hands in the dust, and aim himself to pray at Mecca, or where it used to be. He'd been pals with a fellow called Zulfugar, but when any prisoners looked like they were getting too friendly, the guards separated them to different ends of the line. How they thought any of us would survive with our bare hands, carrying 20 pounds of chain in that wilderness, I don't know, but they put me next to Shamsuddin to break the two of them up. The guards watched us pretty closely, so I had to glean information out of him a piece at a time. One day, crouching down beside him in the dust at one of the water stops, I found out that he was 46 and that he had been born in Bukhara, one of the old silk cities in the south. He left to train as a surgeon in the Far East and returned to work at a hospital back in his hometown. He had been a wealthy man and had managed to bribe his way north when the troubles started. I told them that from what I had observed, it only took 3 days before desperation and hunger overturned all civilized instinct in a person. He smiled and said I had a bleak view of human nature, and that in his experience it was nearer to 4 days. His chains clanked as he scooped up the water in his hands. I asked him what kind of surgery he had done. "Noses," he said, and there was just the trace of a smile.
"You were a nose surgeon?"
"I made the women more beautiful."
"Don't Muslim women go covered up anyway?" I said, and he laughed.
The guards rode past and chivied us to move on. We ambled on, all 80 of us, getting into motion slowly like one big, reluctant animal.
"I don't suppose you could do anything for me," I whispered to him with a wink.
"There is nothing wrong with your nose."
"I wasn't thinking of my nose."
"What were you thinking of?" he asked deadpan.
"You are very gallant," I said. He looked me over carefully as though it was the first time he had noticed anything odd about me.
"An acid burn, I think." "It was lie, but you were close."
"Yes. This is easy to treat. We use chemicals to restructure the epidermis. I would take skin from your thigh to reconstruct the eyelid. I could make you even more beautiful."
That was the nearest I came to laughing. You could see how he'd got rich, charming the cash out of wealthy women.
It meant something to me that he knew I wasn't a man. There was a gentlemanly way about Shamsuddin. He wore his rags well, and when he ate, he didn't wolf his food the way we all did, tearing at it and burping. He ate elegantly, breaking off morsels of food with his long fingers, rolling it into little balls and eating them one by one. I started to do the same. Apart from anything, the food went slower that way, and so there seemed to be more of it. The little I told him of my life struck him as insane. He couldn't believe that my parents had willingly abandoned life of comfort for the cold of the far north. Shamsuddin's own family were all dead, and he had left Bukhara with two companions. They had been hoping to get to the coast to find a boat that would take them south to Japan or even up to Alaska. They'd come across very few living settlements in their travels, and fewer still who'd help them. One of his companions died of dysentery, and the other was shot dead when they broke into a farmstead to steal food. Shamsuddin arrived at his destination alone, almost starving, and all the banknotes in his pockets already worthless paper. He said there was still the occasional boat on the Pacific coast, but the only trade as such was in men and women. About two-thirds of our fellow prisoners had arrived as cargo from Peter Paul in Kamchatka. Shamsuddin had watched on the quayside as they disembarked in manacles. If he was aghast at first, he soon got to noticing that the slaves were better fed than he was. When night fell, he could smell the food cooking over in the slave camp. His guts ached with hunger and his muscles were wasting from slow starvation. He just handed himself over to the guards and begged them to take him. He said he sobbed over his first bowl of food with the shame of what he had done, and he thanked God his parents weren't alive to see his weakness. I told him he was being hard on himself. He wasn't the only one. For every two that were bought, there was another one that had enslaved himself because he couldn't stand any longer as a free man. Shamsuddin aside, the self-enslaved tended to have a harder time of it. There were beast people among us. One man called Handsome killed a man with a rock one night and strangled someone the second. The guards stripped their bodies of their clothes and left their gray corpses by the roadside. Handsome went unpunished. The guards let him walk and sleep alone, so they didn't lose any more men. We were backtracking on the same road I'd ridden on through the fall, the Commissar's Highway. It all looked different with the snow gone, but now and again I'd see places that I seemed to remember from my journey north. We passed Evangeline toward mid-morning around the fourth week of the march. I'd known it was coming for days, and as we drew closer to it, my chains seemed to hang a little lighter on me. Just to be close to home was a comfort to me. I hoped we'd pass the night there. Like the rabbit in the storybook, I felt my chance of freedom would be greater in a place I knew well. I could slip away like Ping had, vanish into the storm drains until the men driving us grew impatient and moved on. I could feel my heart lifting as the tower on the firehouse loomed proud of the trees and the line slowed to a stop. We were there 10 minutes in all as the guards doled out water. There was one tin mug for all of us, but most of the prisoners, me included, had made our own cups of birch bark like the Tungus did. It was cleaner than sharing, and the birch sap sweetened the water. More than that, just to have something of your own, however small, gave you some of your dignity back. But at that instant, standing on the edge of the town that had once been my whole world, I felt, not for the last time, like the ghost of the woman I'd been. I thought I could hear a voice calling to me from a distant part of the city, but the sound was drowned out by the shouts of the guards riding along the line and yelling at us all to move on. There was no rain for weeks after the thaw, and the dust raised up by all those feet meant we were marching through a choking cloud. It coated the trees beside us and turned the prisoners' faces gray. Our eyes were wet and bloodshot and masks of ash. The guards were reluctant to ride at the back of the line where the dust was worst, so for those of us in the rear, discipline slackened somewhat, and we were able to talk more freely to one another, and I got to know Zulfugar a little. He was an old 35, a full head shorter than me, but tough as the devil, and stringy and brown as though they'd made him out of walnut and rawhide. He prayed even more than Shamsuddin. One night, the guards killed a couple of wild pigs and threw us the leftovers, not out of kindness, but to see us fight over the scraps. A big chunk of haunch landed at Zulfugar's feet, but he didn't so much as budge. I wasn't too proud to stoop for food, so I grabbed it and ate. It was part burned, part raw, and very bloody because it wasn't killed right, but my spit still runs when I remember it. I offered Zulfugar a piece, but he wouldn't take it. He said his religion forbade it. Zulfugar had been a soldier, and he was very particular about the state of his feet. He washed and dried his foot cloths every night if he could. Some of the prisoners would rib him about it, as though it was sissy of him to be so concerned about such an unmanly thing. But I soon saw the wisdom of it. One of the men who mocked hardest at him got an abscess on his foot that made his toes go black. He hobbled so badly that the guards cut his chains off to give him a chance to keep up, but he drifted further and further behind, till one day there was just one fewer at the evening muster. A lot more of us started taking care of our feet after that. Another time we passed the outskirts of a town on a river which must have flooded some years earlier. You could see the high tide stains on the buildings that were still standing. There was silt across the highway, and we came across an automobile all crusted with dried mud that looked like it had been swallowed and spat out by a whale. Its windows were all blurred with mud, but it still had an odd poise like something squat and powerful. It put me in mind of one of those low, broad men with sloping shoulders. The rubber of its tires was ripped and splayed out. Zulfugar was drawn to it. He caressed its rear window with his dirty hand and muttered something in Russian to Shamsuddin. The two of them laughed. "He says as a child he dreamed of having such a machine," said Shamsuddin. Zulfugar tried the door but couldn't budge it. The sound of him snubbing that lock seemed almighty loud in the silence. He was so insistent on getting in that I thought one of our guards would shoot him. I took hold of his elbow and his arm went slack in my hand, the way it does when you pull someone away from a fight he doesn't really fancy, and he came along with me, but not without turning to look at the car as it grew smaller behind us. And when we stopped 10 minutes later to fill up from the river, he was still full of his car, banging away in Russian and shaking his head like a hunter who just missed bagging a white moose. There's always those moments with the loss of someone close when the pang just grabs you and doubles you up. Other times it's just another of the facts you live with, like the time of sunrise or the color of the windowsill. In different ways, all of us confronted the facts of what we lost when the world our ancestors bequeathed to us hit the buffers. I had things which triggered it for me. Laundry was one. There was something so sedate and ordinary about the routines of washing linen. But we didn't come across too much clean linen on our march. In some strange way, for Zulfugar, it was all about that ancient car. We lost 11 men on our trek. That includes the two that Handsome killed, a guard who was thrown by his horse, the man who got left behind, and four of the other prisoners. A heart attack, snake bite, malaria, and an older man called Christopher something or other who just didn't wake up one morning. I envied him a little. To be honest, I was surprised that we didn't lose more, but the gangmaster knew his work. He knew when to push us hard, and he knew when to ease off when we were floundering. He kept discipline among the guards, and though there was drinking among them, they never went beyond common or garden rowdy. He rode up beside me one day and started speaking in a low voice and without any introduction. "I hear you fell out with my brother Silas." He was ambling just slightly in back of me, so I had to turn at an odd angle and look up into the sun to see his face. I told him he must have been mistaken, as I didn't know anyone by that name. "I am Caleb Bothwaite," he said. "My brother Silas is who sent you here." He had a kerchief pulled round his nose against the dust, and now he lowered it. I said nothing. He tells me you're a woman, too. I took you for a man that time we met outside the city limits of... what place was that now? Evangeline. That's right. I've been racking my brains to think why you left that place. Someone like you on the move, getting mixed up with my brother. It makes me nervous. He smiled as though to say that nothing in the wide world could ever make a man like him lose his cool. I could feel my cheeks burning behind their layer of dust, but I stayed silent. He looked at me for a few moments and then spurred his horse to the front of the line. He never spoke to me again after that, but I noticed now and then that he would watch me, and when he wasn't, he had detailed one of the guards to give me closer attention. Once I knew they were related, I saw lots of likenesses between Caleb and his brother, the Reverend. They both had the same thin noses and those smart eyes that weigh you up in a second. If anything, I preferred Caleb of the two of them, since he wasn't apt to prettify what he was doing with the name of religion. He wasn't self-deceived. But I got to know him better in time, and I learned he was more dangerous. That look he had I've seen on few men, and it never boded well. In other times it would have been the look of a sea captain or an explorer pushing his men into an unknown latitude, or a military general, perhaps, of the most practical and ruthless kind. But in these times of ours, the material of conquest was much more limited, and he had turned out a trader in human flesh. We all felt we had an idea where we headed for, but no one knew for sure. Rumors would pass through the line about our destination, a different one each day. Someone would say he'd overheard the guards saying we were going to fight in a war. Another would say that the base was a mine and we'd be working miles underground. I tried not to think that far ahead, just sticking to the moment at hand, keeping marching, holding my nose and eyes clear of the dust. There wasn't a soul to be seen on that road, but now and again you'd see a place that looked like it might house someone. There'd be a couple of chickens, perhaps, or a row of beans in the garden. The guards would scoop up anything that could be eaten, and we'd move on. I often wondered about whose meal they'd taken. I suppose whoever it was had learned to hide the moment they saw our dust on the road. By the beginning of June, there was a kind of laggardliness in the line that no amount of cajoling or threats of beating could cure us of. Something in our bones sensed the object of our journey growing nearer, and the fear of what was to come made our feet drag. It was usual for us to stop and make camp toward the end of the day. Although you couldn't tell by looking at it because it seemed so straight, the road had been making a slow arc to the south. The trees had changed. There was more variety among them. Walnuts as well as birches, elm, willow, limes. I had never been this far south in my life before. I almost missed the Arctic summer. In the far north, there'd be no night at all by now, only round-the-clock daytime, and that always gave me a jolt of energy that I enjoyed. But where we'd fetched up, the day unraveled into darkness around 9. We had been growing jumpier by the day. Whereas before, the spurs off the highway had been rare, now we passed more and more of them. There were road signs, too, blackened and twisted and not in any lettering I could understand, but still, keepsakes of something, mementos of the past. I thought of all the other humans who had looked on these signs, arriving here from the west with a sense of wonder and hopefulness as they came to start lives in these cities, a late chapter in the story of humanity. How late, they could never have guessed. And I thought of Ping. How lucky for her that she had been spared this. Sometimes I looked at the guards and wondered if one of them had fathered her child. I could have been fooling myself, but I felt that Bothwaite was too cold of a fish to have done a thing like that. Was it him? The horseman with the Tatar eyes? Or the older one in the patched jacket who ate with his knife and whose slow movements breathed his contempt of us? or the young one with the sweet face, the most junior of the whole crew, who gathered their plates after their mealtimes and fetched fire for their smokes. Would hear them talking and laughing in the evenings, but too far away to make any sense of it. All of them must have had stories like mine and Shamsuddin's. Bothwaite was the child of settlers like I was. One of the others was part Tungus. They were Russians, and a couple of fellows who looked like they were from the Caucasus, reddish of hair, with joined-up eyebrows, gold teeth, and big ears. And I supposed it was just dumb luck that we were in chains and they were on horseback. I told myself that they'd had to unlearn their natural compassion, those who'd had any, just as Shamsuddin had to overcome his squeamishness about slicing up a woman's face so that he could make her more beautiful. But it didn't make me hate them any less. Then, one evening, instead of stopping to camp for the night, and two of us being sent on a detail to gather wood, we just kept going. The mosquitoes were like hellfire in the evenings without any wood smoke to keep them off you, and there were big smears of blood on my arms when I killed them. "Damn it," I said, "they're eating better than we are." "The first time in my life I am jealous of a mosquito," said Shamsuddin. There was only a crescent moon, but the sky was so clear you could see the part of it that was in shadow, beside the tiny piece of it that had been gilded by the hidden sun. Ahead of us the road forked, and we were herded off to the left. The road ran down and then turned back on itself and up to a gate that was lit with a couple of oil lamps. This was a real gate, not like the gimcrack carpentry at Horeb, but a vast door hung on concrete posts, with a chain fence stretching off into the darkness on either side. It opened, without a word from Bothwaite or the guards, and we marched in two by two through the gate, across a large patch of gravel, and into a long, low hut with three lines of steel bunks stretched along it. And for the next 5 years, that was my home. There used to be a look on the faces of some of the Tungus who came into our town to trade or pick up work of naked peasant astonishment. Plenty of them, especially the older ones, had spent time in cities better than ours, but some of the younger ones had never traveled and knew of us only by hearsay. Think of it. A child of the tundra who knew everything about the movements of the caribou, who knew 97 things you could make out of willow and sinew, who could live forever on the stingy soil of the far north. And now he's walking down a thoroughfare, gazing at a child holding a balloon, or a woman with a shopping basket, or the great glass panes of the bakery, pulled every which way by the sudden variety of what's around him, getting bumped and jostled by passers-by and jeered at by rude kids. That poor baffled Tungus was me in my first days at the base. The place had a vitality I had never known except in the town of my childhood. I was so fizzed up I could hardly take it in. The extraordinary, powerful smell of unclean men and animals, the raised voices, the faces of every brown and yellow shade, and the press of bodies in the barracks and at mealtimes, surging together, tighter than a run of salmon. It was days, maybe weeks, before my new life took any kind of shape in my poor, overloaded brain, and until then I just kept my head down, did as the others did, and tried to stay out of trouble. We were housed in two sets of barracks. There were some 300 souls altogether. The barracks had been built for fewer, so the overspill had to fit in somehow. The old-timers had the best bunks. The new arrivals made do with common space on big raised wooden boards. For nearly 3 years, the planks of wood above my head were my whole private world. I shivered under them in winter, sweated there in the heat of summer or when fever gripped me. I could still draw every knot in those planks. I know them better than my mother's face. Almost every one of the prisoners worked at farming, every aspect of it, from shoeing horses to milking cows, from sowing and reaping and preparing feed to salting cabbage and pickling grass in the silo for winter. They mustered us for a head count morning and evening. That first summer, I baled hay in the hot sun all day, and in the evening I milked cows in the byre. I hadn't seen anything on that scale for years. There had to be a couple thousand acres under cultivation. And the land was the good-looking, rich, black earth that the Russians used to tell jokes about. If you leave a spoon in the ground, they'd say, it grows into a shovel. Chernozem, I believe they called it. There was a team that worked in the kitchens. Everyone wanted that. It was considered the softest labor. Plenty of food, indoors all day. The jobs in there went to the most senior prisoners. But I never minded being outside. We had food in abundance. And I have to give it its due. The prison bakery made the softest loaf I have ever tasted. In the first weeks, the new prisoners had that giddy sense of themselves that comes with eating, and a good day in the sun, and the relief that they had arrived at their destination and it was no worse than this. We came in from the fields around 5 for the second head count. "My belly aches," one said in wonder as he wiped his dish with a hunk of black bread. There was a lot of contented snoring in the barracks, and when there were eggs for breakfast, those fools thought they had died and gone to heaven. If we're living this soft, they thought, how can it be on the other side where Boathwaite and his men live? It was like a busy little village in that barracks at night. Most of the men knew at least one trade, and they'd do odd jobs on the sly for the guards, a little tailoring or woodwork. One man built banjos out of scraps of wood and wire and sold them. Another, who had a reputation for cooking plov, was dragged out to make it for the guards on birthdays, and always reeled back from the celebrations drunk. They would generally be paid in drink or smokes or bits of food. There were rumors of women at the base, but I was the only one I knew of among the prisoners, and I didn't lay eyes on another for 2 years. For those 2 years, I was barely alone for 1 second. Even in the latrines, you couldn't escape into your private self because there would be others in there constantly. At the same time, there was nothing that I could call companionship. I'd hoped to stay friendly with Shamsuddin because I liked him and he seemed a decent man, but my friendships with him and Zulfugar didn't much outlast the march. Now and again, I'd have reason to work with one of them, and there was a trace of the old warmth, but most of the time they were following a different road. There were other Muslim prisoners at the base, and they all stuck together for prayers and mealtimes, and fasted together for 40 days in the fall. My being a woman made any closeness with them impossible. And of the other prisoners, they were none that I wanted as friends. The grimness of life at the base had no end. It doesn't make sense to number all the fistfights and the killings and the drinking and the body talk. What struck me, though, was that in all that time, we never had a man take his own life. And as for me, who had got so close to taking my own, it never entered my head to end it there. When Ping and the baby died, my life had taken on a kind of looseness. It was a strange feeling for a person like me who wakes up every day with a belly full of fight. It's hard to explain how it was, but back then, after she died, between this and that, there seemed to be no kind of meaningful difference. Not in anything. When I threw myself in the lake, I think I was already 3/5 dead and I just wanted to stop breathing. And yet, when I remembered my life in the cabin from my stinking berth in the rack of bodies at the base, it seemed like the most beautiful part of it that had ever been. All the space, the music of the water, only myself to please. But that was where I had wanted to die. Now, here, I woke up each morning raging to live. All my energy burned on living. How to eat better, how to keep myself strong, how to lay by warm clothes for the winter. When I dug or baled hay or humped potato sacks, I did it with the intensity of prayer, and my prayer said, "Keep my body young. Let me outlast this place. Let me not die here in the stink of these men." Many times I thought of escape. We had the chances. But the guard's best weapon in keeping order